listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The situation in Syria was the topic of discussion at the UN Security Council on Thursday. Press TV's Waqar Rizvi has more.
Russia says terrorists have ignored calls to cease resistance and lay down weapons in eastern Ghouta, the flashpoint countryside of the Syrian capital, Damascus. Moscow also says militants in eastern Ghouta are preventing civilians from leaving the conflict zone. According to the Russian military, talks to find a peaceful solution in eastern Ghouta have failed. Earlier, the Kremlin called for a UN Security Council meeting on the situation in the region. Russia's UN envoy, Vasily Nebenzia, also expressed hope that Security Council members will come up with ways to resolve the crisis. Clashes in eastern Ghouta have been raging on for weeks. The recent shelling by foreign-backed militants has left dozens of civilians dead. The Syrian government has also been accused of carrying out airstrikes on the area. Damascus says its air raids are in response to attacks by militants.
China's permanent representative to the UN, Mao Zedong, said that only Syrians can solve the problems of Syria.
Mr. President, I wish to thank Russia for its initiative to hold this meeting. I also thank USG Lowcock for his briefing. Recently, the security situation in parts of Syria, including its capital Damascus and the eastern Ghouta region, has escalated, causing large civilian casualties and drawing wide attention from the international community. China would like to express its profound sympathy to the Syrian people for their sufferings. We condemn all acts of violence that target civilians and civilian facilities and harm innocent lives. China always believes that there is no military solution to the Syrian issue. It would only aggravate the sufferings of the Syrian people. Political settlement is the only way out. The pressing task now is that the international community needs to support the Syrian parties in resuming dialogue and negotiation under the UN mediation as soon as possible, and seeking a solution accepted by all parties through the Syrian-owned and the Syrian-led political process. It is the only way to fundamentally ease the humanitarian situation in Syria and rid the Syrian people of their sufferings at an early date. Terrorist organizations are still launching attacks in Syria, which have caused large civilian casualties and impeded humanitarian relief efforts of the UN. The international community should strengthen cooperation on counterterrorism, adopt unified standards, and resolutely combat all terrorist organizations designated by the Security Council. Mr. President, as part of the Syrian issue, the humanitarian issue in Syria is closely linked with Syria's overall situation and its political process. Actions taken by the Security Council on Syria's humanitarian issue should not only help ease the overall humanitarian situation in Syria, but also help consolidate the momentum of ceasefire in Syria and be conducive to the bigger picture of political settlement of the Syrian issue. China calls upon the Security Council to remain united on the issue of Syria, speak in one voice, and create favorable conditions for substantive progress in Syria's political process at an early date. Thank you, Mr. President.
However, the idea that only Syrians could solve the problems of Syria was not shared by the man presiding over the Security Council on Thursday, that being the permanent representative of Kuwait, Ambassador Mansour al-Otaibi, who's presiding over the council for the month of February. He said this before Syria's permanent representative Bashar Jaafari had an opportunity to speak.
Before giving the floor to the distinguished representative of the Syrian Arab Republic, I would warmly encourage His Excellency, the representative of Syria, to speak for only 5 minutes. Thank you. I thank you. I give the floor to the representative of the Syrian Arab Republic.
Thank you, Mr. President. We were not aware of this decision to speak only for 5 minutes. This is why I oppose this decision, and I reserve the right to express the view of my delegation in this very important meeting that is dedicated to the situation in my country.
This was the permanent representative of the Russian Federation, Vasily Nebenzia, who had requested the session earlier this week.
Mr. President, we fail to understand why you're proposing a decision to limit the statement of the representative, the ambassador of Syria, on such an important issue which we are currently discussing, a statement from a country that is directly implicated in this, a country where all of this is directly occurring. We must afford an opportunity for the representative of Syria to speak for the duration of time for which his statement has been established. I do not think there need to be any artificial limitations on his statement. Thank you.
I thank the representative of the Russian Federation. I did not take any decision. I encouraged the representative of Syria to adhere to the note 507, and then I gave him the floor. We have agreed on this. It is stated in note 507. Thank you very much. I give the floor to the representative of the Syrian Arab Republic. Thank you, Mr. President. Once again, I reiterate that we're not aware of this note, and I believe this is unjust. To impose these restrictions is unjust, and it actually unveils a number of points that I'm going to refer to in my statement anyway. I hope everybody is patient to listen to my statement on behalf of my country. I'm not going to present a personal statement. Everybody spoke on behalf of their governments, and I'm here to speak on behalf of my government. And I encourage you all to listen carefully to what I have to say. Mr. President, I speak to you today while hundreds of rockets and mortars are targeting the capital Damascus in this very moment. Up till now, the injured amounted to 37, among them six children. Two children were killed. This does not come as a surprise. As you know, every time the Security Council held a meeting to discuss the Syrian situation, we needed to have a massacre here and an attack there, and a killing of civilians in some Syrian cities. We've seen not dozens, but hundreds of massacres over the past 7 years.
I think
the radar of Mr. Lowcock did not catch those messages. Mr. Lowcock just didn't receive the view of the Syrian government that we have expressed in hundreds of letters that we sent to him and to you. Mr. President, some members are not objective, are not neutral, are not impartial. Whoever asked for a point of order showed that it is involved in the developments in my country. We thank the delegation of the Russian Federation for calling to hold this open meeting to give us the opportunity once again to present the reality of the suffering of civilians as a result of the practices of armed terrorist groups. Excuse me, of course I mean moderate armed groups, moderate armed opposition, that over the past 7 years has been sowing death and destruction wherever it were operated. It used civilians as human shields. It targeted schools and hospitals and turned them into military centers. It has been hurling missiles and rockets indiscriminately at residential and populated areas. Of course, this is a form of resistance, as we've heard from the permanent representative of France before he left this meeting. He referred to them as resistance that the Syrian regime is trying to suppress. This meeting is particularly important as some actors, especially the United States of America and the so-called International Coalition, these actors moved from the stage of proxy aggression through supporting terrorism to the stage of direct aggression. Those actors recruited terrorists from all four corners of the world. They called them jihadists and sent them to Syria. Whenever a terrorist failed, these actors were present militarily, politically, through the UN and through the media to intervene and seek to achieve what its terrorist proxies failed to achieve. Let's be clear here. Some council members, and I specifically mean the United States of America, the United Kingdom, and France, would like to deprive the Syrian government from its constitution and sovereign right of defending its territories and people, a right that it stated in the Charter. Back then, when we had wise founding fathers and international law, and all UN resolutions on counterterrorism state that right. Today, I heard you speak of a draft resolution on humanitarian issues. The pen holders are Kuwait and Sweden, and I thank him for their efforts on this draft resolution over the past weeks. However, this effort is deeply flawed. You did not coordinate with the Syrian delegation at all. You didn't even ask to hear our view on a draft resolution on my country. Let's imagine for a moment, ladies and gentlemen, that hundreds of terrorists has used Bois de Boulogne as a center to target civilians in Paris, using dozens of missiles every day. Do you think we would have seen a draft resolution calling for a humanitarian truce to give the moderate armed French opposition the opportunity to regain its power and launch missiles targeting mass Paris? Let's imagine for a moment that hundreds of terrorists have used Central Park here in New York as a center to target civilians in Manhattan and launch dozens of missiles every day. Do you think we would have seen draft resolutions calling for medical evacuations of moderate armed American opposition? Let's imagine for a moment that hundreds of terrorists use Hyde Park in London as a center to target civilians in London every day with dozens of missiles. Do you think we would have seen draft resolutions calling for delivering humanitarian aid to moderate armed British opposition?
وهل كنا سنشهد بيانات عن كبار موظفي الأمانة العامة؟
Would we have seen statements by high secretariat officials such as Mr. Lowcock calling for stopping the fight against armed groups and describing them as non-state armed opposition groups? Unfortunately, this is how UN documents refer to terrorists nowadays, non-state armed opposition groups. Mr. President, of course, these are all hypothetical scenarios that might seem far from the reality. However, it is the reality in Syria, a tragedy that we're seeing in Syrian cities every day, including the city of Damascus. It's a bitter reality that the Syrian government is facing as a result of erroneous approaches adopted by the United Nations and positions of some countries. Damascus is one of the oldest populated cities in history, as you know. It is seeing destruction, death, and sorrow every day as a result of missiles, mortars, and rockets launched by armed terrorist groups operating in eastern Ghouta. They are terrorist groups that are designated as terrorist groups in the United Nations, ISIS, Al-Nusra, and affiliated groups. Today, 8 million people live in Damascus, among them hundreds of thousands that fled armed groups that attacked their villages and homes in many parts of Syria, including the eastern Ghouta.
إن الأمم المتحدة تعيش اليوم أزمة مهنية وأخلاقية.
The United Nations today is going through a professional and moral crisis that is unfathomable. High Secretariat officials find no harm in adopting the positions of governments that sponsor terrorism in my country. They are directly involved in distorting facts, manipulating figures, using insidious phrases and terminology, and relying on unreliable sources in its statements and reports. Of course, I can't present all those scandals today. I will only remind you of the report of the fact-finding mission, FFM.
الصادر في شهر حزيران 2018 بالوثيقة
S/1510/2017
الذي أشار إلى أن من بين المصادر المفتوحة التي اعتمد عليها في هذا التقرير هو الطبيب البريطاني شاجول إسلام.
Is a testimony by British doctor Shagul Islam. For those of you who don't know who Mr. Islam is, he's a foreign terrorist fighting for Al-Nusra Front in Idlib. He's previously convicted in the UK. He was not allowed to practice medicine in the UK as he was involved in terrorist crimes. For instance, involved in kidnapping British journalist John Cantell. This is only an example.
تتم ممارسته في بعض تقارير الأمان العام.
An example of the misleading reports of some of the UN secretary documents. We are convinced that these abhorrent practices will not stop and that some UN officials will ignore the serious information that we convey to it
concerning
the following. Armed terrorist groups made up a fictitious story indicating that the Syrian government used toxic chemical substances against civilians in Ghouta. These groups are training their members to pretend that they've been exposed to toxic substances. Of course, these scenes are broadcast. And the Syrian Arab Army is blamed for it. We conveyed hundreds of letters to the Secretary General, to the President of the Security Council, and to specialized UN agencies on counterterrorism and the prohibition of chemical weapons. However, we are confident that some in the United Nations will not hesitate in adopting those tales and in blaming the Syrian government. This is simply because the power dynamics and agendas in this organization compel some to join the extortion of the Syrian Arab Republic and its allies that are fighting terrorism. Fighting terrorism on behalf of you all. Mr. President,
the Syrian government,
for over 2 months now, has been sending almost daily letters to the Secretary General and the President of the Security Council, documenting the number of missiles that have amounted to, in the past few weeks, 1,200 missiles. We have been documented the human and material casualties and civilian casualties in the city of Damascus as a result of being targeted by terrorist groups in Eastern Ghouta. However, the Secretariat has no problem in ignoring the suffering of 8 million people in Damascus in its statements and appeals. It has not hesitated in participating in the misleading campaign launched by some countries to protect a few thousands members of terrorist armed groups in Eastern Ghouta. So they're sacrificing 8 million civilians in Damascus to protect a few thousands in Eastern Ghouta.
إنما تروج له مصادر دولية وأممية
International and United Nations sources على الغوطة الشرقية are spreading news of a stifling siege on Eastern Ghouta. This is not consistent with the reality on the ground.
عن منطقة حيوية.
We're talking here about a lively, vital area that is the main source of food to the city of Damascus.
وحركة الشاحنات التجارية لم تنقطع منها وإليها.
Commercial trucks have been moving constantly between Damascus and Eastern Ghouta. The Syrian government has facilitated the delivery of humanitarian aid to people in Eastern Ghouta, as long as conditions on the ground allowed. We've also approved medical evacuations to governmental hospitals in Damascus. The truth that we all know, that High Secretariat officials know, is that terrorist armed groups are those who control humanitarian aid that enters Eastern Ghouta. It is those groups that distribute this aid. There's another truth that the Secretariat is ignoring. Residents of Eastern Ghouta has taken to the streets protesting against the practices of terrorists that pointed their guns at the innocent people. Of course, these besieged innocent people are also sending messages, but the radar of Mr. Locock is not catching those messages. I would like to ask the Secretariat, how does it justify ignoring the reports and information that the Syrian government presented on hostages and kidnapped people detained by terrorist armed groups in Eastern Ghouta at the so-called At-Touba prison? They need immediate medical evacuation. The United Nations is ignoring video footage posted by armed groups showing that women and children of those hostages are being pushed into metal cages and left on the street. It is a painful scene that is reminiscent of the times of slavery. This is true insanity that the Secretary General has spoken of yesterday. Of course, there is terrorist insanity that we're witnessing in Eastern Ghouta, and we must put a stop to it. What is even worse is that some in the Secretariat are trying to use the agreement on de-escalation zones to distort the facts and to ignore repeated violations perpetrated by terrorist armed groups. They're being instructed from the outside, from actors that are present in this meeting. They're instructed to target Syrian military sites and launching attacks using rockets, missiles, and car bombs on the residential neighborhoods in Damascus. Mr. President, groups operating in Eastern Ghouta are terrorist armed groups. Regardless of how they change their names, regardless of their affiliations and their allies, today we're talking about Jaish al-Islam, Al-Rahman Corps, the Dawn of Islam Corps. Yesterday we were talking about the Islamic Front, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, and Al-Nusra Front. I invite you all, ladies and gentlemen, to take a look at the website of these jihadis. Take a look at satellite TV channels that Western satellites are helping to broadcast. You will see that they all share the same Wahhabi terrorist ideology. They all call for Takfiriya ideas and call to annihilate the others. Any attempt to change nomenclature will not change reality. It will not prevent us as government and with support of our allies, prevent us from defending our citizens in implementation of your resolutions on counterterrorism. Mr. President, some who are among us today are using the suffering of the Syrian people and are trading with their blood. They're demanding accountability while they're supporting terrorism. They're directly involved in military aggression against my people, as was done in Palestine, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Africa, and Latin America. The dilemma that we're facing today is that the mechanism of work inside the United Nations is being held hostage to financial and political polarization. As a result, the United Nations is completely disregarding the crimes of the so-called international coalition led by United States of America. As my colleague from the Russian Federation said, this coalition completely destroyed Al-Raqqa. It killed hundreds of civilians, destroyed infrastructure and bridges over the Euphrates River in many areas of Syria under the pretext of fighting ISIS. It used internationally prohibited weapons against civilians. Of course, we've seen that in Vietnam. This is what the United States has done in Vietnam. Those are the weapons that were used in Vietnam. It targeted Syrian armed forces and allied forces more than once to lift the siege on ISIS. This coalition and its militias actually reached a deal with ISIS so that ISIS fighters, their families, and their heavy weapons could leave Raqqa. The United Nations is completely disregarding repeated aggression by Israeli occupation forces on the territories of the Syrian Arab Republic as part of its support to armed terrorist groups. The DPKO has no idea of what is going on in Golan. The United Nations itself is completely disregarding Turkish violations to Syrian sovereignty and its direct military aggression on Afrin. I don't think any of you has address this issue in the statement. In conclusion, Mr. President, to respond to those who fear that Eastern Ghouta might become a second Aleppo, I invite you to go today to Aleppo and see with your own eyes how millions, not thousands, millions have regained their normal life after Aleppo was liberated from terrorism. Yes, Eastern Ghouta will become a second Aleppo. Idlib will become a second Aleppo. All areas suffering from the terrorism of armed groups will become the second Aleppo. Because we will not succumb to those who have supported terrorism in Syria. We will not be complacent to the plans of the governments of five countries that met in Washington last month to divide Syria and to ensure the failure of the Sochi conference and the failure of the Syrian process as a whole. This piece of news was unveiled today in the UK. We will not be passive towards those who use terrorism and unjust economic measures against the Syrian people and use military aggression to achieve cheap political agendas. I assure you, ladies and gentlemen, that very soon history will show that we and our allies have fought a war on behalf of the whole world against terrorism, supported by governments that will be held accountable by its people and the world. Those governments have invested all they had in terrorism and threatened its own cities, its own citizens, and in all parts of the world. When I look at some of the faces in this council and become aware of the political hypocrisy, I think, and I remember the famous saying by the great Russian writer Dostoevsky. He said, "Rest assured, hell is big enough for all. It doesn't deserve all this fierce competition on who will be the worst." End of quote. Thank you, Mr. President.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
I have the honor to interview Alistair Crook. He is a former EU diplomat and founder and director of Conflicts Forum, and we discuss the Middle East. Alistair, welcome to Moscow, and thank you for talking with RT. Let's start out with Syria. The conflict has been going on almost 7 years now. Part of that conflict has come to an end with the almost complete defeat of ISIS and its affiliate allies in that country, primarily proxies. Now this conflict is changing. How is it different? What's this conflict about as opposed to the former one?
You know, it really is quite tragic because Syria was slowly coming to a conclusion and coming to an end, and a political end, with a political solution that was going to very likely emerge from Sochi and these other Astana processes going on. And now suddenly we have new wars, and we have a new episode
of
war.
You used the plural, wars.
Wars.
Explain.
We've got three, at least, wars. The internal war is slowly going. The war against the jihadists is winding down. Syria's had a big success in Idlib, which I always thought was going to be much more difficult. But in practice, it's almost finished. So we should be moving directly towards a political situation. Instead of which, we have, first of all, America deciding to have a permanent base in northeast of Syria on 30% of Syria. Why do they want that? It's nothing to do with putting pressure on Assad to get a better constitutional agreement or whatever. There's something quite different about that. It's a very aggressive positioning, using the Kurds as it. Even though the Kurds are not a majority in this part of Syria at all, they're actually no more than 30% in that part. Maybe a majority in Afrin, but not in this part.
25% of the country.
Yeah, yeah. 30 or 40 maybe, but a lot of the country there. And really what this is about is first of all, simply to deny President Putin a political solution to Syria in advance of the elections here.
This is spite? Is this what it is? Is this the politics, the diplomacy, or a military doctrine of spite?
You could call it that, or you'd say it's the policy of the lowest common denominator, which is to stop Assad or Putin having a political victory from Syria, or being, winning in Syria.
Or maybe it's just a policy of not knowing what else to do.
No, it's been a very clear and deliberate policy by CENTCOM, who act as viceroys in this area. The colonel in charge of it acts as a viceroy in this area. It's a very deliberate policy to deny the territory, and they say, this is clear, to try and build it up economically. And it's not a short-term thing to do with Astana, because if you look at the defense estimates for 2019, not this year, but the following year, you'll find $550 million earmarked for the Kurdish forces that the Americans are using.
You said wars, three. You just did one.
Okay, one more there. The second war, of course, is Turkey has come in to Afrin and says it's going to go all the way across the border of Turkey, right up to the Iranian border, past the north and the Euphrates, to the, and to clear out all of what they call the Kurdish terrorists there, along that border. But in the middle of this, there's an American roadblock called Manbij, sitting straight in the middle of the road that the Turks are going to go, take. And the Americans say, we're not budging. And
but the Turks say they're not budging.
And the Turks say, we're going anyway in that
two
direction.
Two NATO allies, the two most important NATO allies in the entire alliance.
Exactly. And the rhetoric in Turkey is really heating up very strongly. Very nationalist, very anti-American, very strongly everyone. And not only they say they're going to go and we don't care, but there's also conflict with the Syrian government forces now. The Turks have put their positions in Idlib almost to block the Syrian army from completing their operations. Part of it is legal in the sense that it's part of the de-escalation zone, but you know, this is also politics, geopolitics of Turkey trying to block it. And now we have an agreement. It seems it's a formal agreement between the Kurds and the Syrian government that Syria will come in and take over the Afrin area. And the Turks are saying, no, we're going to besiege Afrin. So there is a real risk now that not only there can be, a war in the northeast, either with the Syrian forces or Syrian forces or Russian forces in the northeast, but a conflict between the Turks and the Americans, and a conflict or both between the Turks and the Syrian armed forces.
Well,
and then we have Israel, which has been bombing regularly Syria during this period. And as you know very well, last Saturday, there was the incident where we were that close to a war, very, very close to the war, with the shooting down of an F-16, not only an F-16, but the most sophisticated F-16.
It's been reported that President Putin and Prime Minister Netanyahu had a conversation, and it was quite heated. We don't know what the contents of that were, but I tend to agree with you. It was very close to the line right there. De-escalation was necessary. But it's also showing force, okay? I mean, and it's also debated to what degree Syria took the initiative to defend itself. Over the years, there have been 100 incursions from Israel over its sovereign territory, and that plane went down. So it is upping the stakes here.
Oh, I think it's quite clear that this was a strategic decision, probably not only by Syria, but perhaps by Syria and its allies, to make a new red line after Israel kept, if you like, not only disrupting any political process in Syria by these methods too. I don't think they were doing that much damage to Syrian, from what I understand.
Well,
but it was an effort to show Israeli force, to show that they had the ability to overfly. Now, what is critical in this, and what is very obvious, is that the air defense of Syria is totally unified and integrated with the Russian system. It carries a Russian flag on it. It's not just a Syrian flag. So clearly, when they were firing what they described as a bouquet of 27 surface-to-air missiles at the Israeli aircraft coming in, you know, the Russians knew all about it. I'm not saying there was permission or they nodded, but they didn't take action against
that. All the players that you've talked about, they're not the bluffing type. I mean, particularly the Turks. Erdogan has invested an enormous amount. There's not a lot of wiggle room for him here, okay? Assad, you know, great swaths of his country are still under foreign occupation here. The United States is there. Almost no one of all the parties we mentioned wants the United States right there. And then we have two other countries we haven't talked very much about, Lebanon and Iran.
You know, I think this is... I think precisely this was the aim of Mr. Putin's talk with the Israeli Prime Minister, to say, listen, you know, okay, you may have your interests in your security, we hear that, but you don't mess up Syria, that's our security interest. That's Russian security interest, okay? Not just Assad, we want a stable Syria, and we want a stable Lebanon, and you can't just send in planes every week to bomb the country and disrupt the political process in this way. It's unacceptable. And I think this was the message that was delivered both physically and by telephone to the Prime Minister. But it's a very strategically huge message because Israel depends entirely on air superiority.
Overwhelming.
Totally.
Total.
I mean, the army, they made a decision after the 2006 war that they couldn't put boots on the ground in Lebanon, let alone in Syria, for more than 6 days. I mean, it would not be possible to do this. So air superiority is crucial. Do they have it now? I don't know. Do they have it in Lebanon? Maybe not.
But it's been tested, that's for sure.
It's been tested, and now Israel has a huge decision. Do you actually accept that and digest it and effectively say, we are deterred. We are not able to use our military force against the Arab neighbor,
which would be a fundamental shift in its entire military posture in the region.
Cultural shift. They culturally have been used and assimilated to the idea that they have complete domination of all of their Arab neighbors' skies and that they have the military right to use it. And suddenly they're being told, well, you know, maybe there's a problem with the, you know, coming in. And of course, I mean, you know, Putin's given his warning. So the Israelis also have to think. I don't know what missile was used. I doubt it was an S-200, but it could have been. But what also is there are S-400s, who are very potent Russian surface-to-air missiles. Now, if they ignore Mr. Putin's message and say, we're just going to take it all out, there's going to be a problem. The Israelis claim to have taken out most of the surface, the air defenses of Syria. Mm-hmm. I don't believe
it. I don't buy
because,
it either.
Because, as I said, it's an integrated system with Russia. It has a Russian flag on it. They're not going to take out Russia's surface air defense system because it would be unacceptable. They know that. So they took out a control tower or something like that. But, you know, what do they do next? Do they accept this? Do they say, well, look, the air defenses of Syria and Lebanon are only going to get better in the long term. We must try and take an early preemptive action to destroy them before they become even better. What are they going to do? Are they going to say, well, we have to just come to terms with a reality, much as we dislike it, that we have lost our military
security?
What are the
possibilities of that before we go to the break? Accepting it. It doesn't seem part of their DNA.
I think culturally almost impossible to accept it. I think they would try and find some means to avoid acceptance. I think
Let me jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the Middle East. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to our interview with Alistair Crook. We're talking about the Middle East. Alistair, before we went to the break, we were talking about a cultural shift and maybe a strategic shift in Israeli thinking because of what's going on in Syria. But it's always about Iran. It's always about Iran. And I know that, you know, as an expert in the region, there's a lot of bluster in the rhetoric that comes out, and you know, you have to kind of decipher it. But we know that Prime Minister Netanyahu, who's in trouble politically, domestically, because of corruption charges and allegations. And then when we had this a shootdown of this Israeli plane, the Israeli media and the military talked about, you know, these about Iranian depots and supplies in Syria, as if Syria really isn't even a sovereign country here. How much is, with this shift that you were talking about, and we have the hawks in the Pentagon and the White House when it comes to Iran, is there something coming together right now? That Iran is always a target for these people. Has it moved up to another level?
Yes. I think it's changed. In a sense, I mean, what you're saying about Israel is absolutely right, but it's not a consensus in the security establishment of Israel. The prime minister and his father before him have been Iran hawks, and everyone knows it. But the security establishment, don't forget, many of them said afterwards and have said subsequently when Trump became president, they said, listen, the JCPOA is an Israeli interest, is our interest. So it's not absolutely black and white in Israel. But where it is black and white is in the circle of the White House, where you have Iran phobes from the head of the CIA to the National Security Council. I don't know how it's happened, but Trump is surrounded by people who believe Iran is the source of all evil. And of course, Netanyahu feeds this and is capable of using this. And of course, we have in Saudi Arabia another Iran-phobic person. And something happened before the UN Security Council meeting in New York this summer, because there was a meeting, and Netanyahu had a meeting with Mr. Trump, and the next day he produced that extraordinary diatribe against North Korea and against Iran, and labeled Iran as the source of all evil. I imagine that somehow that Netanyahu promised him an Israeli support for action like this. And then what happened? Saudi Arabia tried to contrive the circumstances for an attack on Hezbollah by forcing Saad Hariri, the prime minister of Lebanon, to unwillingly retire. And the security and the army of Israel, the dog didn't bark in the night. They didn't go.
There's
for
a lot
it.
Of negative enablers going on here, a lot of them, and it's a very toxic mix when it all comes together. You know, you talked about Trump and his generals. He seems to have just kind of abrogated his responsibility to this. That's the impression I have, because we see Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State. He's overruled, even publicly, quite often when it comes from North Korea to Syria, maybe even towards Iran here. I mean, it seems like a very much a military foreign policy, because we've had these posture reviews come out, security, defense, but I'm not expecting a diplomacy review to come out anytime soon.
You know, I mean, people have talking about caging the president and containing him, but in this respect, I don't think it was so unwilling. I think he likes it. And, you know, he keeps talking about my generals, and I think he actually, I'm commander-in-chief, and these are my generals. I mean, there's something that feeds into Trump's ego.
Well,
and
he's literally feeding them with these immense defense budgets. Immense.
And they feed him by saying, America has got to be respected, and America has got to be powerful. And he says, absolutely right. You know, this I agree with. So I think it's voluntary. What is particularly significant is the move we've had from, if you like, the Steve Bannon circle, which were in a different philosophical view, who said America has to be as America is culturally.
Culturally.
It has to
right,
be
exactly,
culturally
right.
America. But it also implied that Russia could be Russia as it was. And that was a basis where you could have a foreign policy. We have now a group of generals that are revisionist generals who believe in fighting the Vietnam War to prove that the Vietnam War was never lost by the Americans.
And let's not forget, we have Nikki Haley as their bullhorn on the world stage. I mean, when it comes to Israel, when it comes to Iran, I mean, this is she just perpetuates this echo chamber.
You have to see the language was very important in the second statement. To begin with, Russia and China were competitors and rivals. The second statement, their revisionist powers. Now, that has a very specific meaning. It has a meaning that those powers will use military force to undermine the status quo, the world order, after the Second World War. In other words, it's saying Russia and China are seditionists against the accepted global order.
Or just challenging American hegemony in its unipolar moment. I'm giving a different interpretation of that document.
That would be quite different. And then they go on to say, so, and these seditionists have taken advantage of us, so we're going to have to rebuild a whole nuclear deterrence. Submarines, missiles, new weapons, and we're going to build the whole
and
of
the process, infrastructure. Mutual assured destruction is eroded.
It's more than eroded. It's more than that, because what we're seeing is the blurring of the borderline between nuclear war and non-nuclear war. I mean, when they talk about, you know, using tactical nuclear weapons conventional setting, then where's the border goes? It becomes blurred. And even they've just given a contract for having cruise missiles with nuclear weapons. Well, if you're a state and, you know, people fire cruise missiles, how do you know whether it's going to be nuclear or going to be conventional? It's a big blurring of the whole process.
But the message in that posture is, if you read it rationally, in a detached way, it is a justification for the United States to use these
precisely
type of weapons. It's not a deterrent to Russia and China.
No, it's explicit.
Right.
It's explicit in it that it will use it, and even that preemptory action is possible against states that might be likely to acquire nuclear weapons.
Let's stay with this posture here, because it focused on Russia, China, and of course North Korea, but it almost in a dismissive way stopped talking about, and remarkably, considering how these two words, the war on terrorism, that has been degraded. I mean, it's a term that was invented by the United States,
yes,
to wreak havoc, unbelievable havoc, in the Middle East and beyond. And now they're walking away from it.
They are. And this is really, I mean, what you're pointing to is really significant, because what we have in its stead, and they are very explicit about saying it, these are forever wars, generational wars. Our enemies, we will fight them by coin, which is any means, information war, cyber war, any type of war, regime change, over a generation or more. And so Russia, Iran,
but doesn't that
are
guarantee
generation
it?
Wars.
Doesn't that guarantee that there will be perpetual wars? I mean, just it's really quite circular.
Of course it does, yes. And of course, we're already seeing Russia reading this, China reading it. When I say war, when it comes to Iran, I don't think there's going to be hot war. I think we're going back to 2014, and there'll be financial sanctions, there will be attempts to undermine it by counterinsurgency messages, and then there'll be financial war on Russia, sanctions, and on China, there will be tariff wars. China is the one thing that they can bring everyone together with in the Democratic, the Republican right. Party. Everyone's agreed we must have economic war on China. We must cut China down to size.
And, of course, it means that there is no foreign policy debate at all in the United States. It is really quite remarkable. In 2003, when the United States was about to illegally invade Iraq, there was a huge anti-war movement. Now it's gone. Let's change gears. During the Cold War, it was an open agreement between the United States and the Soviet Union that you don't kill each other on the ground. You can use proxies all you want. That's changed in Syria. And I don't think a lot of people understand that, because there is every reason to believe that the U.S., out of self-defense, that's the new justification for regime change now, targeted Russian contractors and killed them. That's something that didn't happen during the Cold War.
No, I think it's you're right. It's a very serious escalation. And I think that it's likely to continue, because Iran and Syria, I think, have both made it, certainly Iran has made it explicit, that if the Americans do not leave voluntarily, they will be made to leave Syria. They've said the same about the American presence in Iraq. I think that in the northern part of the Middle East, there is a clear determination. I don't mean this is a conspiracy. I'm just saying there's a clear consensus of a view that the American presence in Syria and in Iraq is going to be disturbing to the stability of the whole region.
We have it's upcoming in Istanbul, where we're going to have the Russians, the Turks, and the Iranians. Now, those three parties have their differences when it comes to Syria, but they are all united on one issue. They do not want American presence, illegal under international law presence in Syria. Is that enough to keep them together?
No. I mean, it's more complicated, but I think the relationship between Russia and Iran, although there are a long history of disagreements, but it is a real strategic interest, partly because of the financial war. They need, both Russia and Iran need, if you like, commercial depth in order to survive any sanctions that are put on them. So both of them benefit from that, and China is part of that axis. Turkey is more complicated, more complicated. Sometimes it seems to do what was agreed in Astana. Sometimes things don't seem to work out quite like that. Sometimes it's not clear what their ambitions are in Syria. Sometimes there's a cooperation. And at the moment, when you read the Turkish press, you see they're angry at the Americans, they're angry at the UAE, they're angry at Syria, they're angry at
Russia. How much intentionality is it, or are they just playing it on the fly? I mean, because I agree with you. I mean, what's Turkey think today?
You know, I don't know. We don't know, because I think one of the great difficulties, I mean, Erdogan is not predictable, and, you know, Ottoman language and Ottoman sentiments are rising, and the people are with him. Let's make no doubts about this. He's got the full support of the
people. And that's what worries me, is because this operation, Olive Branch of all names, invading northern Syria, he can pitch it as being anti-American, and his base loves it.
Yes, yes. And also, he's somehow actually, in a way, managing to bring some sort of togetherness between the secular base and the religious, pious base of Anatolia.
Yeah, but he's creating a gilded cage for himself as well, because he has to succeed. Alistair Crook, that's all the time we have. It was wonderful having interviewed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for talking with RT.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.